Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast from the magazine that bows to no king, with, of course, the exception of Elvis and Nick Gillespie's ASMR. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy VE Day, everyone.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
That's right. So I will get the frank admission up front here. It is weird to be a libertarian during a pitched partisan slash journalistic battle between entrenched political camps, when people are suddenly up in arms over a seemingly random topic and nearly 100% sorted by their political affiliation. It can be a little bit hard to sort through the truth and hold on to our own sense of perspective. Such it has been over the past month of multi-outlet journalistic attacks on the alleged conflicts of interest among the conservative jurists on the United States Supreme Court. We already talked about the first tranche, focused mostly on Clarence Thomas's relationship with conservative donor Harlan Crow in our April 17th podcast, at which Catherine was notably absent. But there has been an...
I recused myself due to conflicts of interest.
That's good. There's been...
Because you just love statues of Stalin or something, is that it?
Who doesn't?
She was in her Freedom Garden of Evil and Robots. In the interim, 2 weeks, I guess, 3 weeks it's been since then, we've had, in bullet point style, a Politico piece about Neil Gorsuch selling a Colorado ranch he co-owned to the CEO of a law firm that has brought 22 cases before the Supreme Court. An insider piece about John Roberts's wife making $10 million as a law firm headhunter between 2007 and 2014. A ProPublica piece, another one, revealing that Harlan Crow, if that's his real name, paid around $100,000 in private school tuition for Clarence Thomas's grandnephew, who the Thomases had legal custody of at the time. The Washington Post also discovered that Federalist Society honcho Leonard Leo, quote, arranged for the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas to be paid tens of thousands of dollars for consulting work just over a decade ago, specifying that her name be left off the billing paperwork, end quote. In each of these cases, there were no disclosures filed of those pertinent bits of information, which the justices say is actually in keeping with the requirements for written disclosures. The Senate Judiciary Committee last week held a hearing to talk about all this stuff. There are currently three relevant bills making their way through the process. Catherine, since you weren't here last time, and anyways, all this has happened since then, what is a libertarian to make of all this smoke? Is there a fire behind it? And if so, what is the fire?
So my initial response is just a very, very deeply cynical one. And I don't necessarily think that's the best or right response, but it is kind of where I went when these first stories came out. And it has only deepened as more of these stories have come out, which is like, did people think this wasn't happening? Of course this was happening. Obviously, in this city where everybody is entangled with everybody and everybody's wife works for a consulting firm and everyone's husband is a advisor to the whatever the hell. And I guess, you know, if you're going to have a lifetime appointment, you're going to wind up entangled with all of the power players in this city. That is inevitable. But that's not helpful, right? Like, that's just like flat cynicism about the way that this city functions. I don't think there's anything special about the court. I think you could scratch any senator, especially those who have been around in some cases for what feel like lifetime appointments, and find the same levels of conflict and entanglement with some of the big players in D.C. I think that it is true on the left and the right.
Or, for example, former senators who are now presidents,
just for instance, yes. My second response is whatever is wrong here, and some things are clearly wrong here. The Senate is not going to fix them, both because they, you know, first of all, physician heal thyself, and second, because I don't want the Senate to have more control over the court. I don't think that that way lies anything good. And I don't want eternal kind of cudgeling over ethics disclosures I think the court can and should set its own standards. I think those standards should probably be higher. But I also don't think we can be in a situation where the, you know, these people who have served as jurists, who have in some case practiced law, are kind of continually recusing themselves. There will be arbitrage on that front as well in ways that I think will not be good for actual smart decisions by the court. So I don't think the Senate can or should be fixing this. But I do think, you know, it's yuck. Like, the cynicism doesn't mean I like it. And I think that the idea that they are seeing, that the court is seeing cases from people with whom they have relationships and not sharing that information and not stepping back in some cases is clearly a problem. I think the court can and should make their own rules internally to do better.
Peter, Chris Hayes from MSNBC had a big sort of segment on this. The way they worded it on his tweet over there was, Leonard Leo and the right had a problem. They were putting people on the court and then couldn't control how they ruled. So they came up with a twofold solution to create a captured court, one that explains the many Clarence Thomas benefactors. This is a direct quote from Chris Hayes. He goes on in the piece to talk about the 6-3 conservative supermajority, its dangerous decisions, and makes a broad allegation of corruption. Do you agree that there is corruption at the Supreme Court along these lines?
I think corruption is probably too strong a word. At the same time, I do understand where people are coming from when they use it. But let's back up here. I think Chris Hayes is a good, smart liberal pundit, but he's also an interested liberal pundit. Well, he wants to see the fire that you talked about, right? Like that you said there's a lot of smoke here, right? But like Clarence Thomas didn't start the fire, right? It was always burning since the world's been turning, guys.
The minute that you gave us that little smirky cadence, I was like, oh no. Yeah.
He didn't start the fire, right? And there is like, this is a product of something that I sometimes refer to as the simulation problem in Washington, D.C., which is like if you've ever played a video game with a huge cast of characters, right? Like you're Spider-Man, you're like flying around New York and it's just like populated by all these people on the street. You can go dance with them. That's the thing you can do in the Spider-Man game. It's actually the case that most of those people that you see on the streets of New York in the Spider-Man game are not like really people who you can talk to or interact with in any sort of meaningful way. And Washington, D.C., there's just a really small cast of people that you can interact with and actually have a long conversation with and who are like deeply important to the plot, right? And like some of them are Dr. Octopus and Aunt May and et cetera, et cetera. And Washington, D.C. is like that, right? It seems like there's a lot of people here, but in fact, you just keep running into the same person over and over again until you like start to wonder if in fact you are in a simulation that can only handle 50 people at a time. And they all just seem to like circulate between the same dinner parties and bars and social events and that sort of thing. And you're like, oh, I haven't seen this person for 3 years. I guess they're being brought back by the writers. The simulation was like, we've got to cycle in a new character. And I suspect, I'm nearly certain, in fact, that that is true for Supreme Court justices as well as for journalists. That they have to, that like their lives are actually comprised, you know, their social circles are not tiny, but there's just like it's a relatively small group of people who sort of circulate in and out of the kind of business funding, ideological, is it advocacy, right? Sort of the world of like high end conservative jurisprudence and like and court stuff is just not that big. And so because of that, you end up interacting with those people in a bunch of ways, right? Like, and some of that is, well, sometimes those people have cases in front of the court, and sometimes you're buying and selling property with them. And that doesn't mean, that's not like we should just ignore it. It's fine. Don't worry about this at all. That's not what I'm saying. At the same time, there's almost certainly like a lefty version of this, right? And you can go read in now the kind of copious reports that have been produced about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for example, like giving a speech at a thing that was named in her honor while she was still, while she was still a sitting justice, right? Like it was sort of a fund set up and like with a group that had cases before the court and was like involved in court business, just all sorts of stuff like that, you know, with legal ethics experts saying, actually, she's crossed the line. And so I guess my feeling about this is part of it is just a reflection of the social situation. Part of it is pretty clearly a concerted effort by forces on the left, by sort of left court ideologues, right, to create the sense that the conservative justices on the court are in some sense illegitimate. I mean, and that's not a word that I'm making up here, right? Brian Fallon, the executive director of Demand Justice, is out there saying that that's a lefty court advocacy group. And he's out there saying ethics rules, you know, new ethics rules are not going to be enough. The whole court majority lacks legitimacy. That is a direct quote. And so there's just, it just seems to me like a lot of this is social circumstance. Some of this is sort of cynical, ugly business that is happening. Some of this is bad judgment, especially on the part of Ginni Thomas, who I think has just displayed a bunch of bad judgment over the years. And that bad judgment doesn't necessarily have to reflect back on Clarence Thomas or on his legal decision making. But Ginni Thomas, I think, probably should have found some other way to like make a living rather than being very, very, very involved in court adjacent business and in sort of right of center court money. So what's my answer to this? I don't think
we would like to know.
What's my answer is I don't is,
yeah,
is like
Peter, you've had plenty of time. You've had plenty of time.
Yeah. I'm not that interested in hearing it.
Is that Chris Hayes, your question was about Chris Hayes, and Chris Hayes wants there to be a single conspiratorial system that explains all of this. And instead, it's a bunch of stuff that is a little abnormal and a bunch of stuff that is happenstance and a bunch of people kind of just doing normal people things. And also, the justices are not obviously breaking the letter of the law when it comes to a bunch of these disclosures and these ethics rules. And I think that is also important, too. And so it's just like it's not a conspiracy in the sense that Chris Hayes wants it to make it a conspiracy, which doesn't mean that it's not kind of ugly and not worth knowing about.
Nick, without using any Spider-Man analogies.
Oh, no, that's exactly where I'm going.
I want to know whether I was Doc Ock or am I Aunt May in the DC.
No, I was hoping that Peter was going to assign a Marvel supervillain or a Spider-Man supervillain to each of the Supreme Court justices.
Ooh, don't tempt
him. And I just want to point out that my favorite shitty Spider-Man supervillain from the 70s, maybe early 80s, but late 70s, was a Mexican bandit named the Tarantula, who had his superpower. He wore, you know, a mask. It wasn't a luchador mask because they weren't really popular then, but he had really super pointy shoes, and he would kick you with these shoes that had spikes. And it seemed to me very racist.
Is that a superpower, or is that just clothes?
It's, you know,
that's
what?
Batman,
he was a supervillain, and I hate that you're questioning the legitimacy of a Mexican supervillain.
Thank you.
Oh, what do you think they, you
this
know?
This is an incredible, it was, like, vortex, by the way, of the Suderman.
I'm just trying to get, I'm trying to save, but I feel like, I'm feeling like I'm what's her name in Titanic, and I'm on a door floating in the North Atlantic. Everything's really cold, and I'm just trying to keep Leonardo DiCaprio.
There's enough room for Peter, but you're not going to let him up on the door.
No,
yeah,
no,
I get
no.
it.
He could talk. He could talk as he slips into hypothermia. two very quick points. One is
not in this
that
weather, man.
We have a historic low approval rating of the Supreme Court. According to Gallup, in 2000, 62% of us had a positive view of the Supreme Court. That is down to 40%. The judicial branch, more generally, federal judiciary, has also tanked in similar proportions. And, you know, that kind of matters. And it's, you know, I'm of the mind that everybody always wants to blame people, you know, like we're the problem. We don't have trust and confidence in institutions anymore because we're nihilists or we're stupid or, you know, we've lost the faith. But it's like, you know, it's mostly how these institutions govern, particularly the political ones. And the Supreme Court acted poorly or acted obscurely in 2000, when they decided the 2000 election, they have acted poorly in a lot of different decisions, including the Obamacare decision, where, you know, it's common understanding that Judge Roberts had, you know, ruled in one way and then kind of went out of his way right before he issued his ruling to kind of come up with something that contradicted himself. And it reads like a really shitty school paper, you know, that he crammed on the night before because he realized, oh, I did something that was going to get me a bad grade. And the Supreme Court, like all other political institutions, is suffering from a crisis of legitimacy. And they really should do something about this. As everybody has said, none of this is probably technically illegal or even against their own rules. Matt, in preparing for this, I went back and looked at Abe Fortas, who was an associate justice appointed by LBJ, who was very liberal. Among other things, by the way, he ruled in the Tinker v. Des Moines case, or he argued in that for maximizing student rights, even past the schoolhouse door. But when LBJ tried to elevate him to chief justice, he got hammered for accepting $20,000 to speak at American University from private sources. And he ended up resigning. Nixon threatened him with an investigation. John Mitchell, one of the shittiest, attorneys general of all time, threatened him with investigation. So none of this is new. Strom Thurmond filibustered him, et cetera. Like, none of this particular thing is new. What is different is that the Supreme Court is at a historic low in terms of public legitimacy, and they really should do something to fix that. And we should do something to hold them accountable, even if this current raft of stuff is, you know, plainly political in its emanations and its objectives, coming from the left, you know, and now the right has come up with their own, you know, litany of abuses. It's up to the Supreme Court to do something.
Catherine, on Nick's plainly political accusation there, more than his questionable use of the plural on attorneys general. I think that was really attorney generals in that case.
Is it attorneys general?
No, he's not, because he was
just attorneys general.
I think, no, one of the
attorneys general.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think, anyways.
I'm so sure.
Catherine.
Can we talk about the tarantula a little bit
I
more?
I just want to see a picture.
Or ethnic supervillains, which are, to be quite honest, more interesting than the Supreme Court.
Matt, I beg you to ask me a question about the Supreme Court.
Here's the question. It's amazing to see like a half a dozen news outlets within the same month, big investigative deep dives, all in the same direction, on the same topic, with different characters and different things like that. At the same time, that's journalism. That's we're seeing more. We have more information than we did before. It's helpful to know more things. Is part of the decline in trust and the reduction of legitimacy caused by what seems to be like a lopsided journalistic take in the course of getting into a partisan pitched conflict?
Yeah, I mean, so in the same way that Chris Hayes wants to see a conspiracy, I think it's tempting, for people on the right, for fans of these justices who are under attack, to see a conspiracy there, too. Look, this is proof that the media, they all get together at the cocktail parties with Peter Zuderman and they plan their coverage. And this is what we get.
We talk about Negroni ratios.
I read it a little bit differently, which is that these were openish secrets. Like, the reason that we were able to get so many of these stories so quickly is that once there was a demonstrated public appetite, it was very, very easy to know where to go looking for these stories. Because, again, if you are a reporter in Washington, D.C., if you are a human in Washington, D.C., in these sort of rarefied circles, you know that this sort of thing is going on. And so they weren't hard stories to find once there was clearly a market for them. I think people are really mad at the court, right? And so that's why we're getting these now. We, you know, the Dobbs decision obviously is a top line here, but the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, I think, you know, you can go back there. You can, of course, go back always and forever deeper into the darkness of Supreme Court history. You know, anecdotally, the you know, the nice white parents, quote unquote, that I hang out with, don't think the court is legitimate anymore because they're really, really mad at some of these decisions. And that's a new thing. And so, of course, once you kind of have come to this conclusion, you're going to retcon it. You're going to go back and you're going to say, like, well, how else can I know that these guys are the villains in the story? If they're not wearing Lucador masks, what else could we use to discover the truth? And, you know, fancy vacations paid for by someone else are a good signal that they must be the bad guys. That's kind of where I take it. People are in the mood to be mad at the court. And so there is now a market for these stories.
Right. And particularly people on the left. And you see this now stated explicitly in some cases where you have lefty journalists and activists basically saying the goal here should be to delegitimize the court and to try to reduce public trust in the court. And I think it's at least a little bit telling that the left is stating this so explicitly, that the court is one of the few super elite institutions in the United States right now that is that has a conservative majority, and that liberals, rather than trying to sort of be good institutional stewards and fight from the inside, have decided to say, well, let's tear it all down. And that's a bad tendency in American politics, whether it is on the right or on the left. And I think we see it coming from the right and the left right now in different ways, because both of them are mad about the institutions they don't control.
Yeah, but I also am like, yeah, let's tear it all down. You know, I mean, I as I've said many times on this podcast, am deeply sensitive to and sympathetic to the Gillespian critique that actually low trust societies don't become libertarian societies. I think that's obviously true. At the same time, it's all bad. It's all bad.
But aren't you the person who has said on this podcast many times that the let's make it worse in order to help people right. understand looking, that it gets better theory always fails?
I'm not looking to immunitize the eschaton. I just think it's also like the impulse to bring down from without. I get it. I don't think it's the right one. I don't think it's going to be effective.
I think we need good and effective institutions that also have a proper sense of their role and scope in society.
I mean, I need a unicorn
Can I suggest something?
Yes, I'm bazillion
Matt,
dollars.
Just as Major League Baseball this year.
Yes.
Is undergoing, you know, it's done a couple of things to try and increase viewer interest, spectator interest, and belief in the game. The Supreme Court needs to be doing that. The Congress needs to be doing that. The presidency needs to be doing that. One of the things that's interesting is that institutions can be destroyed, you know, from within or without, but ultimately, the way that they regain trust and confidence, and I do think that would be positive, particularly in the judiciary, is for them to actually do something affirmative and positive and public to acknowledge, you know, the fact that, you know, 40% of Americans, only 40% of Americans approve of the Supreme Court. It doesn't have to be that way. And, you know, in 19, going back in the late 60s and early 70s, the Supreme Court was super controversial, particularly under Earl Warren. And they had higher approval ratings. Part of it is because as a society, we were dumber and more trusting of a government that at every turn was lying to us. But, you know, it's up to the Supreme Court, just as it's up to Major League Baseball to fix itself. It's, you know, this stuff is not going to come from without. And on this level, even though the attacks on it are fairly cynical, very political, very intentional, and they are the exact mirror of the past 30 years of Republicans, including Republican presidents, talking about how the Supreme Court is, you know, should not be legislating from the bench and that it's a purely political institution and all of this. It's up to the Supreme Court really to do something, you know, if they give a shit about whether or not the American people, you know, actually trust them, that they're doing their jobs in the way that they're doing.
All right. Speaking of public trust and the lack thereof, on Friday, Rochelle Walensky announced she was stepping down after 2+ years as director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. just days before the federal government is scheduled to lift the last of its pandemic mandates and restrictions. That happens on May 11th. That's VP Day, right? Reasons Robbie Suave, if that's his real name, wrote that, quote, Walensky's reign was chiefly characterized by her extreme reluctance to reverse the CDC's support for ongoing pandemic restrictions, including repeatedly extending the CDC's eviction moratorium, which is a thing that happened. She also, again, quoting Suave, put incredible faith in junk studies that purported to prove the importance of mask mandates in schools. And bonus fun, throughout her time in charge, the CDC became the de facto internet speech police. President Joseph Robinette Biden II had a more charitable view of Walensky's tenure, saying, quote, she led a complex organization on the front lines of a once in a generation pandemic with honesty and integrity. And she leaves the CDC a stronger institution, better positioned to confront health threats and protect Americans. Peter, is the CDC indeed better positioned to confront health threats and protect Americans?
No.
Okay.
Just no. And if you want me to stop there, I can. But I wouldn't. So your summary of Robbie's post is helpful in terms of explaining some of the top line stuff that libertarians should and do care about with regards to the CDC's performance. But I would actually point folks to Scott Gottlieb's book on the CDC during the pandemic.
Of course you would.
Yep, because it's really good about how the CDC, even as a technocratic, bureaucratic institution, just absolutely shit the bed. They just did stuff that they should have known better than to do over and over and over again because of bureaucratic inertia and dumb sort of institutional infighting and a bad sense of their own mission and what they were there to do. And they just blew it. And it's not just that they blew it in the sense of, oh, they sort of failed and didn't live up to like what they should have been doing. They probably made the pandemic worse. They probably drew it out. They probably created circumstances where more people died than had to. We have a center for disease, you know, control that probably let the disease of the of the millennium, of the right, of our, certainly of our lifetimes, go out of control more than it needed to, right? Yeah, right. And it's so like they failed in sort of libertarian ideological ways, but they also failed just to do their own basic bureaucratic stuff well. And when you have organizations that are administrative organizations that are supposed to be in leadership positions, that are supposed to be institutions that people can look up to, that set policy, that set tone, that like that exercise leadership that people are supposed to trust, and they obviously cannot be trusted even by their own standards, that's a very bad place to be in.
Catherine, what makes you stabby when thinking, or the stabbiest when thinking about Rochelle Walensky's performance as CDC director?
Well, I definitely am not going to be able to beat the stabbiness that Robbie Suave brings to this beat. I mean, just being in the room with him when Rochelle Walensky is mentioned, just like it's a little bit scary. And I admire that. That is correct. She is absolutely a villain in the pandemic story. I think she is leaving in disgrace and rightly so. I am happy that I can go back to not being forced to try to remember over and over whether she's spelled like Smith and Walensky. Yep. Or differently, because she's not a mid-range steakhouse or whatever that is. But it's, you know, just the incredibly striking similarities of the way that both she and Fauci just bald-facedly lie about what they were trying to do and what they did during the pandemic. Like, she's been less public with it, but both of them are just, yeah, and Randy Weingarten, I would put as the third in that trio. We were trying to get the schools open. We were, you know, we wanted to get the truth about masks. We were just, you know, and I do think when they say we were just doing our best, that part is true. I think they were just doing their best, but their best sucked. They did a bad job. And they should all go home and think about what they did.
Nick, is there retconning now, do you think, along those lines, where somehow nobody is responsible for closing the schools or recommending that toddlers be masked or a bunch of the other things that drove people particularly yeah. crazy. Are we rapidly approaching the moment where not a single person whose fingerprints were on the murder weapon will admit that they did what they did?
Yeah, absolutely, Matt. And there, throughout Europe, particularly countries that either colluded with the Nazis, there's a whole subgenre of literature that came out shortly after the war ended, where it's short stories and novels of everybody wondering how a country, whether it's Romania or Hungary or whatever, like countries that actively collaborated with the Nazi government. They, there were a series of smart novels and short stories mocking the idea that like everybody was like, how did this happen? Because nobody I knew, did anything, collaborated at all with the Nazis. We were all anti-Nazi.
We're the resistance, man.
Et cetera.
All of us were.
Yeah, or whatever.
The kale of the French resistance.
Yeah, it's, and, the one thing that I'll say is, to kind of continue, the deeper through line of the earlier conversation, Walensky took over from Richard Redfield, right, who had the C. Everett Koop beard and was completely incompetent, right, at CDC. I mean, the only thing you remember about him is that stupid beard. Like the Quaker Oats guy or C. Everett Koop. And he, in fact, he replaced, and people forget about this before the pandemic, he replaced Brenda Fitzgerald, who Trump had put in, who lasted 3 weeks. She quit after Politico noted that right after becoming the head of CDC, she bought a bunch of stock in Japan Tobacco. And people were like, that's kind of a weird thing for somebody in charge of the CDC to like go log on Japanese tobacco. But the CDC used to be held up as one of the great governmental agencies. And part of it was because it was located outside of D.C. We have this constant ongoing idea that, one of the ways to increase government efficiency and whatnot is to get the agencies out of D.C. If only they get out of the swamp, they'll be touching Indians in the real world, in the real America. And the CDC was always at the top of that list. And it's just been a crap organization for a very long time. And again, public opinion, is like half of what it was 5 years ago, believing the CDC and the recommendations. This is a bad, bad thing. The pandemic, revealed, and there's a great Justin Monticello video that I'll put in the show notes about this, that what it revealed was not that the CDC made a bunch of atypical blunders, but in fact, that going back decades, the CDC had kind of screwed up everything that it was doing. They were almost always a net drag on public health because they saw it in overly broad terms and then made bad decisions. And this really brings it home. So it's good that she's gone.
Yeah, and because they are a centralized, overconfident authority, and this is a big thing that we saw over the last few years, is that they make two major category mistakes. The first is they say, we're the gatekeepers on everything. And so anytime you might have a situation where there could be multiple gatekeepers and essentially competition between deciders, the CDC likes to step in and say, nope, we are going to be the sole point of decision making, and then, as a result, the sole point of failure. So they weed out sort of competing views and by saying that they have to be the ones. And then they're hyper confident about everything. And you saw this just about every time Walensky appeared in front of Congress. She was just like, well, we know that toddlers must be messed forever. And actually, that's been the science for decades. This is well known, right? And just this, like, then they will just state stuff that is, maybe you can find some studies that are perhaps not even all that high quality, right? But stuff that is highly in dispute or contested or barely proven as absolute certainties. And then when you combine that with the fact that they centralize all of their decision making and position themselves as centralized decision makers for everyone else, you end up with a huge amount of failure.
Do you think, though, that one problem is, I mean, there's not just a lack of faith in the CDC, which clearly screwed up, but also in the type of science the CDC is meant to rely upon. And I think that, like, if we're sort of making a case for the CDC, and there certainly is a libertarian case for something like a CDC. Now, not the one we have, but, you know, in theory, an advisory body with no force of law behind it that can aggregate information and communicate it in an authoritative, like, it didn't work. Maybe it can never work. But there is a story you could tell about a body like a CDC that would be, you know, not stomp on people's liberties, that would not lead to the problems that you just described, Peter. But then I think we have this sort of second hurdle, which is that as people have diminishing faith in science, particularly in social science, particularly in science where there are politicized outcomes because of the reproducibility crisis, because of a bunch of other things, the CDC's job has gotten harder. And I think that's, you know, that is another piece of this, that there, even the most perfect CDC, like if you put garbage in, you're going to get garbage out. And you will recall, reason listeners and readers, that before the pandemic, the CDC spent all of its time telling people not to vape and that they were too fat. So the CDC did not do itself any favors by getting into places where the science is particularly weak and then doubling down on that. But
that's partly because the, you know, and they're kind of the exemplary case of this, where public health started moving away from things like, you know, infectious diseases, where there is a case from a libertarian or from a limited government point of view to suspend civil liberties in certain circumstances for, you know, particular periods of time. To this general lifestyle stuff, about like obesity as a public health epidemic and things like that, or vaping the way that they did it.
I mean, so, the conclusion here is read Jacob Salem, and that's the end.
Yeah. Well, we can have an effective CDC if it is doing public health in a kind of circumscribed, more historically limited version of public health. But once you start to talk about public health as everything, you're in big trouble, because they also, you know, had, you know, various things about gun violence and whatnot. I do. The other person who's great to listen to on, you know, the overreach and the failures of the CDC is Alex Tabarrok, who is, you know, not an anarchist by any stretch, particularly when it comes to public health issues, but is a very effective critic of both the long and short term mistakes made during the pandemic and before it by the CDC.
And an illustration of the corruption of science that Catherine's sort of pointing towards is what Walensky and the CDC did in February of 2021. It was the first big heave. If you recall, Joe Biden said, well, when we control the federal government, we're finally going to follow the science, because that clearly wasn't happening under Donald Trump. He was politicizing the science. And in fairness, Donald Trump, whenever he would give a daily press briefing about what was happening with COVID, did not inspire a lot of confidence in his grasp of science, generally speaking. But in February 2021, Rochelle Walensky, who as a private citizen the summer before, in June and July of 2020, was advising school districts to not have unreasonable distancing rules in classrooms, because that would unreasonably keep kids out of school. And that was a bad outcome that was not required in order to protect their lives, according to her way of looking at it, in the summer of 2020, which is pre-vaccine. When we're in February of 2021, what does she do to think about a new set of guidelines for schools? She invites in the stakeholders. This is their word. We're going to consult with all of the stakeholders. Stakeholders, left hand, science on the right hand. They don't mix. Put them away from each other. You do science or you don't do science. You don't have stakeholders, especially when the stakeholders, as was immediately made clear, included the aforementioned Randy Weingarten, who...
God, you're obsessed with Randy Weingarten, man.
Yes, I'm obsessed with people who created damage for millions of people and who are, to this day, to this very morning, still insisting that we did everything in our power to have this, to reopen schools beginning in April 2020. No, she didn't. They didn't. That ruling right then in February of 2021 sentenced millions of kids to hybrid schools and closed schools because places where people had follow the science signs in their yards would do whatever the CDC recommended. Those tended to be Democratic states and cities. Those recommendations required you to have hybrid school. That really screwed up an entire generation of kids. That finding or that recommendation was eventually reversed because it led to incredible howls of outrage among people who are actually following the science. Rochelle Walensky was right there in the middle of that very important decision in which she backtracked on her own previous findings. For that, she shall never be forgiven. Okay, we're going to get to our...
I really hope that you were going to say that she was advising Harlan Crow about the social distancing requirements for his statuary of good and evil. And... you know, kind of somebody in the
Listen,
middle.
Listen, if I can avoid using the wreck of the Brenda Fitzgerald, then you can avoid that pointing out. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first...
It better, the listener question better be about Gordon Lightfoot, Matt.
You must be reading my mind, Nick. A reminder.
Like an old-time
this
movie.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp, and we better get some help here on this podcast soon. Friends, getting to know the mystery of yourself better, including how your needs and your brains have changed over time, is one of the key ways to keep learning and growing and thriving as you make your way through adult life. Letting a professional therapist help guide your discovery process is like having a machete for your walk through the jungle or a GPS system when your car is lost. Don't you want to save time and get your machine to work better? That's where BetterHelp Online Therapy comes in. BetterHelp is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that has helped many, many listeners of this very podcast. They've told me. All you had to do is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist, then start increasing your self-knowledge to break through those barriers right away. Discover your potential with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/roundtable today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder, please send your pithy queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from listener Zachary Barkjohn. Totally real name. Who writes, Dear Reason Roundtablers, I'm a longtime listener, first time writer, etc. Love the show. Thank you, Zach. What is your perspective on HOAs? I believe that is homeowner association. I do not expect this group to be pro HOAs. However, it seems to me for the majority of discourse about HOAs is from people who otherwise look to government to solve problems at an even bigger scale. Aren't HOAs simply the smallest form of government with the most limited scope? More broadly, how do you think about local preferences, i.e. aesthetics, in the context of free riders, Zach? Catherine, you hate freedom and love HOAs, don't you?
I'm not going to say I love HOAs, but I think that this questioner is exactly right, that people who don't want top-down centralized big government type solutions to problems in their neighborhoods are largely speaking too critical of HOAs. Some HOAs are bad, of course, but the concept I think is good. And the way that I sometimes think about, you know, is something good or bad from my little anarchist point of view is if there were anarchy, if we lived in an anarchic condition, what kind of things might emerge? Right. And I don't know, because we're very far from anarchy. So I'm going to be wrong a lot of the time. But it's very easy to imagine that we might have neighborhood sized units in which people make a bunch of agreements about the conduct that's allowed in that space, and that those places could be a single property owner. They could be multiple property owners in a kind of contract arrangement. It would look a lot like an HOA. I personally could not give one single shit about what color the siding is on my neighbor's house. But some people feel agony every time they walk by the one aqua house in their neighborhood. And you should contractually be able to solve that problem. Some people are like very, very pressed about when the garbage cans go out or when the dogs can be walked. Again,
or
I don't
about
care.
The type of garbage can.
My,
oh, man.
My personal
None
HOA
of those metal cans.
is going to be a silly place full of nonsense. But if your HOA is a beige place with matching garbage cans that appear for 47 seconds right before the truck pulls down the lane, you should be allowed to make that arrangement. And I think a lot of people would, because people are like that. I understand that because people sort of choose their neighborhoods for all kinds of reasons, they wind up in an HOA that is suboptimal for them. And I get why they hate them, because petty tyranny grates. But we should be able to opt in to the petty tyranny of our choice, said the anarchist.
Peter, is your HOA mandate 200-pound dogs and basement cocktail bars?
I grew up under an HOA in a big planned community that was sort of planned out in the 1970s and then developed through the 1980s and 1990s with a bunch of little sub-communities. And it was a like an item of great contention in my household that you were not allowed to have a backyard shed that was higher than your fence. And my dad really wanted a shed that was higher than his fence so that he could, you know, walk into it.
It's a dreamer.
And it was just, it wasn't going to happen. No, but I want to take a little bit of an issue with one of the, what the questioner is asking here, right? Aren't HOAs simply the smallest form of government with the most limited scope? I don't really think they're a form of government, at least as often practiced, unless we think of anything that involves a contract as a form of government. And so, yes, obviously, contracts are sort of
rely on
some amount of government to enforce them. But like HOAs, in most cases, maybe not all, right? Some things called HOAs may fly under different rules. And there's, I think, something like 350,000 HOA-type agreements in the United States right now. So probably there's a bunch of variation there. But in general, HOAs are just contracts. And they are contracts that say that if you move in to this place, you're going to abide by these rules. And then if you sell the house, you're going to put in your contract that the next person will also abide by these rules. And so unlike government, and this is a distinction I am pulling from George Mason University economist Brian Kaplan, who has written some smart stuff about this, unlike government, they are built on unanimous consent. Everyone who is governed by an HOA signed a contract agreeing to do so. And that seems to me to be pretty reasonable, and not something that, like, maybe I don't want to live under that contract myself. Maybe I want a shed that's higher than my fence. But there are then other places where one can live, probably in most cases, not even all that far from the shed prohibiting house that you might otherwise have purchased.
Nick Gillespie, have you lived in an HOA environment?
I don't believe that I have. I used to report on them as a cub reporter for the Home News and other Central Jersey titans of print, Matt Welch. And like towns, HOAs often have, you know, ridiculous constraints on behavior that are risible and stupid, but they are semi-freely entered into, or it's, you know, part of what you agree to. In the same way you agree to certain things in towns. The town I lived in, Oxford, Ohio, like most towns, had a really stupid, I think, requirement, that you keep your lawn at a certain length and in a certain level of presentability. And depending on who you were, they would, you know, immediately ticket you if it was over 3 inches high or whatever. And if you were better connected, you know, you got a pass on that kind of stuff. And so all of these, it just foregrounds questions of people in power. HOAs have the benefit of being something that is more explicit. And as Peter was saying, you kind of consent to it right away. But I find the more interesting issue with all of this stuff is, how do things change over time, particularly when desires change? And so there was, both in towns, but also HOAs, when mini satellite dishes became a thing, you know, DirecTV and that kind, and Dish TV, all of them had started out having prohibitions against satellite dishes when satellite dishes looked like you were part of NORAD or something like that. And then a lot of them took a really long time to come around to being like, okay, you know what, you can put a 16 or 18 inch satellite dish on your roof in order to get cable. And you see a sussing out there of just how slow and stupid typically people in power are to actually kind of get behind a new consensus. But I don't have fond feelings for HOAs, but nor do I see them as particularly villainous.
I've never lived in an HOA. I've never owned a house, but I have always, always had a guy on my block who's kind of like the mayor of the block. Like every block I've ever lived on has had this guy. And this guy, he just keeps an eye on things. And sometimes he comes over and says like, hey, I noticed your ivy's getting a little bit in the sidewalk or whatever. And that's just like the primordial form of the HOA, right? It's just that guy.
No, but it's different because you can say, hey, mayor of my street, go fuck yourself.
Right.
You can't do that to the HOA.
In fact, you can by moving out of the neighborhood, right?
So and he's so
it's
like just a question
of how extreme.
Reply.
But, that's extreme.
But I guess for your yard?
I don't think so. I guess what I'm trying to say is I think that there is a natural thing where people want to bring order to the places they live in, and that there's a sliding scale of voluntariness. And Nick is quite right that I could, though I wouldn't, because I like the mayor of my block. I could tell him to go fuck himself, but all the way, of course, at the top end of that scale is the city or the sort of municipal entity, which if you tell that entity
the feds
to go fuck
who
itself,
can bring tanks on your property and
put you in
a cage
and we
for
always
not cutting
want
your grass.
To err as far as we can on the side of the mayor of the block and away from the tanks. Yes.
One thing that is genuinely interesting is, you know, HOAs have a taint of being the thing that was able to get by after different types of covenants in neighborhoods or in areas were banned, that were racially restrictive and things like that. So there's always a taint of the idea that HOAs have replaced racially restrictive covenants. There's a lot of research that I think unfairly, it notes, first off, HOAs are more common in areas with new construction because increasingly, local jurisdictions would be like, we don't want to pay for sewer hookups. We don't want to pay for sidewalks or paving. And so developers will come in and say, hey, you know what, we'll shoulder that cost, but then you're going to charge us a different tax rate or something like that. So HOAs are more common in places with new construction, which tend to be the South and the West, which had these types of things. The other thing that's interesting, I was researching a little bit about this. HOAs are much more common in areas with that have weaker local governments. So when the local government does less, HOAs are more popular because people are opting in for a certain amount of predictability that supposedly maintains resale value.
I look at HOAs not unlike I look at
Major League
marijuana.
Baseball.
I want people to be free to do their HOAs as much as they want, and I'm not going to smoke them myself.
Do you want to smell them though, Matt, when you walk down the street?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to smell an HOA.
Okay.
No, I don't. My mom lived in Irvine, which is the most classic kind of like the Irvine Corporation. Yeah. It's the Peter Suderman of Orange County situation.
It's like a cookie cutter house, Matt, where, you know, just people, non-player characters going about their dull lives of quiet desperation.
As a
punching in, punching out. Big corporation, USA.
Suburbia, I want to burn this podcast to the ground. No, as a child of suburbia, I am very easily bored by cookie cutter anythings. And so I have an aesthetic revulsion to places that impose these obvious restrictions. I remember my mom's place, one of them, you couldn't park a certain type of pickup truck if there's ladders and stuff coming out of them on the street, because that would make people look bad and homeowner values. That's awful. You're free to do that. I'm free to never go to that place. I want to focus on one little passage in Zach's email. It's, how do you think about local preferences, i.e. aesthetics, in the context of free riders? Here's how I think about. I don't really think about the context of free riders. I think about the context of free people. And if a person wants to have a freedom to shoot Nick Gillespie in the face or to paint their house aqua, great. That's normal. And by God, I mean, if you are living in a life where you can't have a shed taller than your fence, everything about that decision fills me with a white hot rage. Again, you're free to do it. But I don't think that a person who wants to freely live a normal expression of their own property rights and humanity, if they're not aggressing anybody else, I don't consider them free riders. I consider them human beings. You can talk to them. If you don't like the cut of their grass, go have the mayor conversation.
Wow.
I love the idea too that, like, so if somebody has a beautiful house, you know, are you a free rider because every time you go by that house where it has, like, still has Santa Claus and the reindeer on the roof? Because why put it up and then take it down? It's going to be there next year. And you go by and that gives you a little bit of happiness.
Zach is asking about
happiness.
The positive,
you know, like, are you a free rider?
He's asking about the positive externalities of a nice looking neighborhood and how we factored those into
I would just say that anyone interested in this question should go watch Reason TV's excellent video about the DC resident who put some giant Transformer statues in front of his house.
He lost.
In Georgetown.
He has been vanquished.
Then he lost.
Yeah.
But he'll be back, just like the Transformers are. You know, the Transformers lose, but by the end of the movie, they tend to win.
But those Transformer statues go to the heart of this question.
They really do.
All right, let's go to the heart of our podcast, by which I mean it's ending soon, and get to what everyone's been consuming cultural-wise. Peter, why don't you start?
I watched Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. It is the latest in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it is really a heartwarming story of a genetically modified experimental superintelligent raccoon who meets a bunch of other bioengineered kind of weirdo experimental animals and becomes friends with them, and then they get murdered. Spoilers. And then there's some stuff that happens after that. And, like, but it's a great weirdo, kind of sicko, kind of sentimental, kind of gross out movie about kind of superheroes, but really just like kind of spacefaring pirate adventurer types, including and specifically Rocket Raccoon, whose story is central to this. It's directed and co-written, directed and written by James Gunn, who of course got removed from this project back in 2018, back when some right-wing troll types resurfaced some of his early tweets, which were really pretty gross stuff, often about kids. So he got fired because Disney doesn't like that sort of thing. And then he got brought back on. And I think what this shows, this movie in particular shows, is how crazy it was to fire James Gunn for being gross. Because what James Gunn does is be gross in a way that is really, really entertaining. And he is incredibly capable, like his ability to calibrate the level of grotesquerie to the audience and to the material and to the PG-13 rating, for example, is really impressive. And what's kind of nice about this movie, what's fun about it, is how sweet and how sentimental it is, despite having like a big sequence where the characters have to laser their way through a giant bio space monster spaceship villain thing. And like it's really sort of just puerile and there's like a lot of body horror in it, but it's also a really sweet story about a raccoon and his friends and his sadness and how he finds a family in this strange and dark world.
Nick, what kind of raccoon sadness did you consume this week?
Yeah, okay. So what I did is I read the novel, which is out in England and the UK and will come out in July in the US. You can pre-order it at Amazon US. And it is called Nothing Special by Nicole Flattery. It's a fascinating, dreamlike novel that I really couldn't put down. It's one of those great reads where you start it and then you find excuses to clear your schedule in order to finish it in one or two sittings. A really powerful universe that you enter almost from the very first sentence. But it's about a woman who works as a typist and as a transcriber at Andy Warhol's Silver Factory in the late 60s. And she's kind of involved in that, but elsewhere, but her life is taking place elsewhere. And it just takes place at this incredible moment where the sexual revolution is happening, all sorts of things are happening. And the new age, which I think we're still living in, the post-war era that left behind everything in the 50s and 60s, is taking place. It's particularly interesting in its kind of discussion and exploration of female sexuality and relationships between mothers and daughters and whatnot. It's, if you like books by people like Sally Rooney, Lee Stein, or Sandra Newman, I think you'll find this really fascinating. It's a really powerful, wonderful book, Nothing Special by Nicole Flattery.
Catherine, what did you consume?
I spent this weekend at the Acton Children's Business Fair. This is an annual event with my kids' school and also one of hundreds of these around the world. It's just what it sounds like. It's a cute little fair that everybody, all the kids have business ideas. They put together a business plan. They do it themselves. And then the day comes and it's sort of a farmer's market type setup. It's great. There's something really wonderful about watching kids do this. And in my kids' case, they learned a whole bunch of lessons, some of them hard ones, about how chocolate melts in the sun. So that, a lesson for us all, FYI. I learned that people really, really like greeting cards. I'm not from a cards family. I don't know if you guys are from cards families, but like we don't send each other cards in my family. And so my daughter struggled a little bit with melting chocolate. My son underpriced his quite adorable little greeting cards and sold out. It's great. It's better than a science fair. I don't know about y'all. Like, my parents always helped me with my science fair project, and it always seemed kind of dumb because I was like, I'm pretty sure we already know how photosynthesis works. Like, I'm not going to be cracking any codes here. Much, much better for kids to learn about something they might use in this world, such as just, I don't know, the difference between revenue and profit, with which some grown people in my life still read news stories and don't understand those distinctions. Children's Business Fair, strongly recommend. There's probably one where you are because there are so many of them, including ones in Hawaii and Thailand and London and all over the world.
So having written recently about the movie Field of Dreams, bingo card, I have taken it upon myself to watch as many baseball movies, which is a category I generally don't like because the quality of baseball is usually pretty bad, among other things. But the people who hate Field of Dreams as much as I at least used to, or have a revulsion against it, always say that they like the movie that I saw finally the other week, which is Major League. Came out literally a month before or after, I think before Field of Dreams did in 1989. It is a farce. It is Bad News Bears for grown-ups. It has Charlie Sheen playing a character called the Wild Thing, and Tom Berenger, Wesley Snipes in an early role, Rene Russo in an early role, and great. And it is incredibly, impossibly broad and funny and kind of winning and charming. It may be a little bit too broad for my taste. Bob Uecker, you've seen, if you've watched any baseball in your life, you've seen clips from this, especially when Bob Uecker says the pitch was just a bit outside and such. It's funny. I get why people really like it. It's not my favorite baseball movie, as it is with so many people. But interestingly, it is the favorite movie of so many professional baseball players because they're all meatheads too at heart. And that kind of fills my heart with joy. That's all the joy that we have time for on this particular version of the Reason Roundtable podcast. Go to all of our podcasts, including the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum debate series at Reason.com podcasts. We had some crackerjack eventage in New York City over the past week and month. Nick, are there other things that people can look forward to in the series that you are presiding over here in the great city of Gotham?
There's a Soho Forum debate coming up in a couple of weeks, but people interested in New York City events should go to reason.com/newsletters and then sign up for the NYC events newsletter. While they're there, and they'll get in on everything before it is planned, even. So.
All right, great. We'll catch you next week. Goodbye.